Live from the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the Todd Albaugh Show. And now, pursuing truth wherever it may lead, here's your host, Todd Albaugh.
Good morning across the Civic Media Radio Network and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. I'm Todd Albaugh. It is Tuesday, the 17th of January, 2023. Along with Mr. Aaron Zommers, our producer engineer, glad to welcome you into hour number three of the big program. Things are rolling along today, Aaron. Just it seems like bada bing, bada boom, we're already into hour three.
That'll happen when we have guests and right? Such, I don't know.
Fine and interesting guests.
Yes, and also the topic of UW Richland Center will always make things go quickly because there's a lot to say about that.
Right, and lots of information to share. So we appreciate that. Appreciate Sean Murphy-Lopez and also Luke Mathers being in the program so far. Coming up at the bottom of the hour today, another fine guest at 10:30, we have Jason Stein, the research director for Wisconsin Policy Forum. They're a nonpartisan group who looks predominantly at tax issues across the state of Wisconsin. And so we're going to be talking this proposed Republican flat tax for the state of Wisconsin. Because, as I said before, last hour, truly want to be fair, truly want to explain to folks what the Republicans are proposing, and then you can make up your mind whether you think this is a good idea or not and how you think it's going to affect you as a taxpayer. So that'll be great. 10:30 today. With Jason Stein of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. A couple of weather and sports or weather and news headlines. Well, sure, we can throw a sports headline in there as well for you. If you live in southwest Wisconsin in the WRCE listening area in Richland Center, you're going to get some snow along about Wednesday of this week, tomorrow into tomorrow night. So be prepared for that. Perhaps 4 to 8 inches possible in the Richland Center area for tomorrow. Today, though, a chance of rain or snow and a high of 34 in Richland Center. Tonight, cloudy, a low of 24. Then tomorrow, in the morning, partly cloudy, a high of 30. And then in the afternoon, maybe by drive time or slightly there before mid-afternoon, the snow starts spreading in. So it could be a messy commute home if you're in southwest Wisconsin from work tomorrow afternoon. Snow continues overnight into Thursday morning. Again, 4 to 8 inches possible. A winter storm watch is in effect for our folks in southwest Wisconsin. Up in Wausau, a hazardous weather advisory in effect for tomorrow into tomorrow night. Today, though, mostly a wintry mix of patchy fog, a high of 36 degrees. Some slick travel in Wausau in the central part of the state. Not a lot of accumulation, maybe an inch or so. And then for tonight, more fog and a low of 24 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, partly sunny in the morning. Storm system moves through. Going to go just south of Wausau, but maybe 2 to 4 inches of snow before it's all said and done on Thursday for Bull Falls radio area. Over in Amory, Wisconsin, expect a high today at WXCE, Lake Air Radio, of around 36 degrees, patchy fog tonight, a low of 24, and then 32 degrees and sunny on Wednesday. Again, maybe an inch or two of snow up in Amory for Wednesday as that storm system comes through. What you need to know, daily headlines for today, as we've been telling you, State Senator Howard Markline of the 17th Senate District and Tony Kurtz of the 50th Assembly District held a listening session yesterday at the Richland Center City Council chambers regarding the UW Richland closure. Many people on hand yesterday, dozens of packed, overfilled room, speaking former State Senator Dale Schultz, asking some pointed questions to his successor. Also, Sean Murphy-Lopez, the vice chair of the Richland County Board, Linda Gentis, county supervisor, chair of the Education Committee, and also former faculty member at UW Richland. There'll be another meeting coming up on the 26th of this month. Going to be on the campus at UW Richland at the Pippin Conference Center, 6:30 p.m. And hopefully Tony Kurtz, perhaps Howard Markline, I know they're invited, and will be there as well. A great opportunity for the county and the community to be involved in this very important decision. After an onslaught of atmospheric rivers recently battered California with flooding, a much-needed break from rain is finally in sight. Flood watches that covered millions of coastal central California areas have expired. The crews will be busy cleaning up the damage for the next several weeks. Another spate of shootings this week is shaking up communities across the U.S. At least six people, including a mother and her six-year-old baby, are dead after a cartel-style execution occurred yesterday in the town of Goshen, California. It appears to be gang-related. This incident marks the 30th mass shooting in the country this year, because the incident was another related shooting, or another shooting, in Florida, in Fort Pierce, Florida, where several people were shot yesterday at a gathering for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Again, the 30th mass shooting this year. We're averaging now two mass shootings in this country every day. Following the discovery of misplaced classified documents from President Joe Biden's time as vice president, House Republicans are demanding that the White House turn over more information, including any visitor logs to Biden's residences where a batch of documents were found. White House counsel's office says, just like any other president in modern day history, the counsel's office said that there is no logbook of visitors going in and out of the president's home because it's a personal home.
I can understand that'd be difficult to find. I mean, I think I misplaced my logbook a few days ago, so.
do you have a logbook of people that come visit you, Aaron?
No.
Oh, you do not? Okay.
Most definitely not. Nobody does.
The Australian Open, if you're watching it, people are not happy because there were a couple of Russian flags in the stand. The Russian Australian Tennis Association says no more Russian or Belarus flags will be allowed in the stands, and that is ticking off the Russians. There are also the Wisconsin Badgers play tonight, trying to get a win at the Kohl Center, the 25th anniversary of the Kohl Center tonight. Back with more after this. You're listening to the All Ball Show on Civic Media. Welcome back to the Town Hall Ball Show, the Civic Media Radio Network, following and pursuing the truth wherever it may lead, no matter whether people want to tell us little lies or not. Nicely done, Mr. Azamer, is trying to get to the truth of the matter of it all. I want to talk just a little bit about these Biden documents before we also turn gears and talk about the flat tax, the proposed flat tax in Wisconsin. So, because wanting to be fair, talked a lot about when these documents were found at Mar-a-Lago and in the Trump areas. And I feel it's important we need to address this and put it out there and be fair. Bottom line is, any classified document should not be in a private residence, right? Unless it's been declassified. That is fair game for anybody to have. But I want to pull a little context. I've said this before. I think I'll just repeat it briefly again. I worked for a United States congressman. I handled military affairs and military issues. I did not, let me make it clear, I did not have any sort of a security per se clearance. I had documents shared with me when I was working on military cases that were not meant for public consumption and was redacted material. And I was privy to knowing what classified documents were and who had them. But I myself did not have security clearance. I want to put that out there right away. But as the job required, you needed to understand what classified documents were and what it meant. And so when something is classified, there's a whole procedure you have to go through in that, okay? And then to declassify them, another procedure. And no, if you're the president of the United States, you can't just mystically think about declassifying documents and they're declassified as Trump claimed. That's not the way it works, okay? But also, there are times, and it appears by reporting from CBS News, that some of these documents in the Biden offices that were found were essentially notes that were prepared for him to talk to world leaders on a meeting, a benign conversation, a conversation. Now, again, if they were classified, they shouldn't just be laying around. But to me, that's very different. And we don't know the full story yet about the Biden documents, let's be clear. But that's very different than what's been reported that was in Mar-a-Lago, in Trump's possession, which were nuclear secrets and information, and also names of undercover assets of the CIA. Assets is the term that is used by deeply undercover people who are counterterrorism, who are acting, if they're in Russia perhaps, they appear to be Russian citizens or nationals, been nationalized Russians. They're working in the Russian government, but they're actually giving intel back to the United States. Those are people, assets as they're called, that take years to develop. Years. And those people are putting their lives at grave risk. Because, of course, if they're discovered, they're most likely dead. And so those that's been reported, that's the kind of information that Trump had at Mar-a-Lago. And apparently, foreign folks from Saudi Arabia and other places were allowed to go into this room at Mar-a-Lago and look at those things. Now, that might have been worth something to the Saudis and other folks, right? Might have been worth something to the Russians. Seems odd that Jared Kushner got paid $2 billion for consulting work from Saudi Arabia. Just seems odd to me. So, and also remember that it took months of investigation and asks by the National Archives, which is in charge of presidential papers. They asked for these documents to come back, was ignored by Trump. FBI got involved, ignored by Trump. Then, I'm speeding this timeline up, I'm condensing it. Through court orders and other things, Trump is basically, or his people are forced to meet with FBI. FBI says, we know we have documents. So he finally says, yeah, we have a few, give them to him. So turned some over. Turns out, did not give them all over. Lied. Then FBI had to go to the Department of Justice and then go before a Trump-appointed judge and get a search warrant. And get subpoenas and get the legal documents to perform a raid at Mar-a-Lago. That does not happen easily, okay? Especially with a former president of the United States. And this is a Trump-appointed judge. And found there was enough. That in order for this to happen, you have to understand, the attorneys for Department of Justice have to basically show enough evidence to the judge that there's almost beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're going to find something. So they go in, they take the documents, they gave Trump's people a heads up, they let the Trump's attorney watch everything. There were photos. We saw it all laid out on the floor. Hundreds, like 300 some different documents of highly classified information. That's very different than a former vice president of the United States having an office in which his staff is now clearing things out, and they find, I believe it was 10 documents at Biden's former office when he was in the private sector between being vice president and president. 10 documents that were basically of notes from meetings that were prepared for him with foreign leaders. Now, we don't know exactly how many or what was in the documents found in his garage next to the Corvette. Again, it appears to be a handful or a few tens of documents. We don't know exactly what's in them or what those documents were. But again, it's very different, right? It's very different of self-reporting versus having to have a federal judge order you to be raided and take them from you. The Biden folks have self-reported first to the National Archives and then to the Department of Justice and turned these over voluntarily. Now, if I were advising the Biden folks, which I am not, my old boss used to say, if you got a problem, hang a lantern on it. It's one of the key rules in politics if you're a successful politician. If I were the Biden folks, I'd basically appoint my own team and say, I'm ordering you to look into my stuff, all right? If there's anything out there, I want to know about it. And then immediately turn it over. And then say, yeah, we shouldn't have these. You know, we messed up. We turned it over. Now, that said, it's my understanding that the Biden folks were told back in November when these documents were found at his office, his former office, it's my understanding Department of Justice said, don't speak about this. Don't talk about it. You've told us that's all that needs to know. So that's why they didn't come forward. Was that the best politics? Was that the best communication? No. I don't know the answer whether the Biden folks were really, it was suggested by Department of Justice not to say anything, or basically they were ordered by Department of Justice not to say anything. That makes a difference. But the point is, it appears that the Biden team and Biden himself have done nothing but self-report and work with the Department of Justice in turning these documents over. Is it a terrible look for Biden? Absolutely. Especially as he gets ready to announce his reelection bid. But it appears to be very different than what happened with Trump and all the items at Mar-a-Lago. I just think that's important to keep in mind.
It appears sloppy and careless. It does not appear malicious.
Aaron, that was beautifully said. And my friends who are listening right now are saying, see, Allball could go on for 10 minutes and Zomers could say it in 5 seconds. You nailed it, Aaron. That's beautifully said. Careless versus malicious. You're absolutely 100% correct. Very well said. That's what it is. And I think that's I was thinking about this morning as I was getting ready. I thought, because I heard Pat Kreitlow and Aaron talked about this morning a little bit. And to me, you know, why what is this all of a sudden thing with classified documents? I mean, you never heard this happen to Clinton. Never happened to George W. Bush. Never happened to George H.W. Bush. Never happened to Reagan. Never happened to Obama. What is it with these two?
And especially if we go like way back, I'm sure, I guarantee that some presidents have brought classified stuff home, or other politicians have used their personal email for things or any things like that. It's really easy to make those mistakes, especially before there becomes a need for things to be so tightly guarded.
Yeah, and yes, there's a need to do that, but I just don't understand. Is it such a volume that it's so hard to keep track of? I mean, again, I go back to my days. I never handled quote-unquote classified documents, but for the people that I worked in politics, there were certainly budget proposals that you didn't want out anywhere. And you were very careful with what you did with that stuff. You didn't just leave it around anywhere.
Yeah, I would think they just wouldn't leave the office. And if they would, they'd be directly on your person with plans to bring them back to the office.
Yeah. I would think someone would be in charge of, you know, who's going to be in charge of the classified documents? Don't we have a special box that we put the classified documents in so they're all together? I don't know, unless there's just like so many of them that they get lost. I don't get it, but it just seems weird that we've never, to my knowledge, had this kind of a problem with former presidents having classified documents in their possession after they leave office, except for these these last two, the most recent. And one a Republican and one a Democrat. Again, it's a very different issue or very different circumstances, in my opinion, of what they did. And it doesn't appear that Biden had some of these ultra classified kind of names of assets and this sort of thing. But it's just sloppy. As you said, it's malicious versus just sloppy. So I don't know. We will see what this all brings. Coming up on the next segment here, very excited to welcome in Jason Stein, the Director of Research at the wonderful group here called Wisconsin Policy Forum, the research director there. Going to talk about this flat tax a little bit and what it means to you and I. What is the truth? What are the facts from a nonpartisan group like the Wisconsin Policy Forum? Republicans proposing a 3.25% income tax, flat tax. Governor Evers, Democrat, vowed to block it, saying it benefits the wealthy over the middle class. What is the truth? What are the facts? Just the facts, ma'am, as Joe Friday used to say. Jason Stein will be in after this with all the facts for you and I on what it means to have a flat tax in the state of Wisconsin, and is it good for us? We'll let you decide after we tell you. Stay with us. You're listening to the Todd Allball Show. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show, the Civic Media Radio Network. Time is now 10:33 on a Tuesday, the 17th of January, 2023. Happy to have our next guest here. I haven't seen him in a while. I used to see him almost every day back when I worked in the building, which is the state capitol. And that is Jason Stein, now the research director with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, formerly of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I was just telling him I miss his writing there. And also, when you work in the building for a legislator, you see the press a lot. And one of my jobs was to deal with the press a lot on behalf of my boss. And honestly, Jason was one of the most fair reporters, always accessible, always willing to talk to you on and off the record. Asked tough questions, both me and the boss, but always very fair about it. And I always really appreciated your approach to journalism and what you wrote. And it's a pleasure to have you back on the show, Jason.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the kind words.
Yeah, absolutely. So how long have you been, you made the transition from journalist on kind of the newspaper side and the digital side with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and you went over to be research director at Wisconsin Policy Forum. How long has that been?
Been more than 4.5 years now, be 5 in May. The Policy Forum is a group of, you know, it's corporations, individuals, nonprofits, and local governments around the state that all are members of the organization and sort of commit to our mission of nonpartisan research that doesn't advocate and just tries to inform people in the state. So it's a fun gig, and I feel like I still get to serve the public in some way, which is
Yeah, absolutely. And people that might not be particularly aware with the name Wisconsin Policy Forum, a lot of the group was formerly called Property Taxpayers Alliance. Is that true?
It was formed by a merger of two organizations, Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance and the Public Policy Forum of Milwaukee.
Okay.
And so it's both those organizations go back, you know, 80 to 100 years in the case of the Public Policy Forum, more than a century. It's a new organization. And also a very old one in the history of our state.
One of the great things about the organization, Wisconsin Policy Forum, and your approach to this, is there is no partisan political bent to what you folks put out and the work that you do. So I kind of people aren't familiar. There's something called the Legislative Fiscal Bureau and Bob Lang in state government. Of course, Bob Lang, in my opinion, one of the most powerful and enduring figures in state government, because he's worked with both parties. He puts it's always, whenever you work in politics, you know, if you're in a private meeting, your boss will say, well, what's Lang going to say about this? You know, I remember, you know, people would say, well, sure, Bob Lang's going to walk into the room and he's going to blow it out of the water because he's a fair guy, right? And so I think that I look at your group as kind of the same type of thing, only, you know, in a you're not part of a government agency, you're an independent private agency. And so that's why I'm happy you came on to talk about this issue of the proposed flat tax, because I truly want people to get the information, not through a partisan lens, but to A, discover what's being, to understand what's being proposed, and then B, how this affects their lives. So looking at an article from Wisconsin, or AP writer Scott Bauer, saying the Republican leader of Wisconsin State Senate proposed implementing a flat 3.25% income tax last week. And of course, Democratic Governor Tony Evers has vowed to block it. First of all, Jason, explain for listeners a flat tax. What does that mean to the average property taxpayer?
Sure. Well, we can unpack this, but in the simplest terms, you know, once you get to your taxable income, and that's a whole process that we can go through in Wisconsin right now, then you apply that income to your tax brackets. And as your, you know, taxable income goes up, you're going, you know, the marginal income tax rates that apply to that income are going to go up. And people with higher incomes are going to be taxed at higher levels on part of their income. And so, you know, those tax rates go from 3.5%, a little over that at the bottom, to almost 7.7% at the top. And what this proposal would do is it would remove the brackets. There would just be one income tax rate for all taxable income, and that rate would be 3.25%. So it'd be a little bit lower for that income at the bottom of the scale, and it would be really substantially lower for that income at the very high end.
So to kind of put it in layman Todd terms, it doesn't matter whether you're working an entry-level job and you're bringing home $25,000 a year, or whether you're a corporate executive making $750,000 a year or more, those two individuals are going to pay the exact same percentage, or roughly the same percentage in taxable income. Is that correct?
Right. On all the rate, the same rate on all of their income. Right.
Okay.
Now, other things about how the tax system will treat them could still be different. I think would still be different. But in terms of just the rates and the brackets, that's how it would be.
So to me, as a dude making well under $100,000 a year, let me tell you, it just doesn't, you know, as a common. So what's the argument, and without taking a side, what's the general argument from Republicans on this, why this is a good thing?
And you've already said it, but I'll say it again. So we don't have a position for or against this proposal, or for that matter, for the governor's either when he comes out with his.
Sure.
But the argument from the Republicans is that as you have, it's various things, but I think the main thing is that as your marginal rates go up, on higher income earners, it's a disincentive to them to go out and earn more income. And so the idea is we just reduce that to that flat 3.25%, that will induce, you know, at least some people, some business owners, some, you know, executives, high earners on the margins to go out and be more productive because the tax rate will drop for them. That's, I think, the main argument, and that in turn would have some benefits for everyone across the economy.
It seems to me, as someone who's got involved in politics back in the 80s with Ronald Reagan, and you know, we heard back, you know, trickle-down economics, the whole idea that if the wealthiest people aren't being taxed as much, then they're going to hire people and give them good wages, and so they're saving, that savings is going to trickle down to the average Jane and Joe, and everybody's going to do better if the highest income earners aren't taxed as much. It seems like there's tenets of that being trying to be sold on the Republican side.
I mean, I think it's, again, yeah, I think the argument is that there would be a benefit to all taxpayers would see their income taxes go down somewhat, but they would go down most for the people at the top, but that there would be some kind of benefit that would flow through the economy and flow through the state. You know, and then there's a lot of other aspects of this that we can talk about. I think what the challenge is with a lot of times with these proposals, whatever it happens to be in state government, is people will get fixated on one aspect of it, and then the discussion never really encompasses the entire landscape. And obviously this is, you know, we haven't maybe quite said it explicitly, but this would be a very significant change. You know, you would have more than a $5 billion impact. Once this plan was fully phased in year four, that would be, you know, roughly in the ballpark of half of what current income tax collections are. You know, the income tax is the state's largest single tax. It plays a very major role in funding things like K-12 schools, local governments, prisons, the state share of the UW system, Medicaid health care for low-income individuals in the state. And so, you know, this would be a very far-reaching proposal that would affect the state.
Before we go any further, let's just give the quickly, again, I know you're not taking a partisan side on this, but just to help people understand the Democratic viewpoint on this, and Tony Evers, is I mean, to boil it down, it isn't fair. I mean, that's kind of what they're saying, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple arguments that you're seeing made on the left. And again, you know, to some degree, I may not make them exactly as people on the left would make them, but the argument is that, number one, there are people that want to see people at upper income levels have higher marginal tax rates, so that they don't want to see it all be the same.
Right.
So that's sort of the first sort of disagreement on both sides. And then, you know, I think there's a practical consideration that this is the main funding engine right now for state government. And also a lot of what the state does goes down to the local level, whether that's local schools or local government. So it's not merely an impact to the state when you have the state's finances hit, because the state is mostly a pass-through entity. It takes money from taxes and then it gives it to other entities that spend it, whether it's local governments or hospitals or whatever. And I think, you know, so there's the argument it's regressive in terms of tax rates, and then that government services themselves tend to benefit people more at the lower income levels, so that it's sort of a double whammy for those individuals.
What's kind of driving this, at least in my view, is the state has fallen upon good times, and very different than, you know, when I worked at
good times, right?
Very, very different than, and you'll remember the late, great former majority leader and state senator Mike Ellis, who used to have a blackboard in his office. And he, Mike, as a staffer, Mike Borger, would sketch out the entire state budget. And there was this talk about structural deficits. And, you know, we're not allowed to actually have a deficit in the state, but we'd essentially have one of the structural deficits. And now here we are in 2023 with essentially a $7 billion, with a B, a $7 billion surplus. And it just seems like everybody's rushing, the politicians are rushing to see how we can spend this and how we can take credit. And so the Republicans are trying to have this tax cut and say, see, we're helping you out at home. And Democrats are trying, I mean, Tony Evers is talking about putting more money into K-12 public schools. And to bring it home to what you just said, Jason, we're having this issue, and we just got done talking about this last hour in Richland Center, where the system is proposing closing the UW-Richland campus there, a branch of Platteville, saying that it's because of lack of enrollment. But ever since 2015, their share of state revenue that goes to the county, which, of course, the county still funds and does the upkeep on the buildings, the shared revenue going to the county. And also Richland County is looking at going to referendum in the spring because of the decrease in shared revenue to also fund their sheriff's department. And so to your point, we have these cuts over time of shared revenue that go to the counties, but here we have now using the $7 billion surplus to give people essentially a tax cut and change it to a flat tax. I think it's important to people, I think you hit on it, that we take these money out of the state coffers, this will trickle down in the form of less money to your community.
So the state does have a multi-billion dollar surplus, and I think it's clear that, you know, even with the threat of a recession looming, and we can sort of debate how likely that is or not, the state has, you know, the wherewithal to increase spending in some targeted areas and to look at cutting taxes in some areas. But a proposal of this size, I think it would be fair to say, when you phase it in over the 4 years, it's challenging to see how you fund government current programs with, you know, you pay for inflation and everything else without, you know, increasing some other revenue source like the sales tax, you know, cutting spending or at least putting very tight limits on it, and dipping into reserves or some combination of those three things. And so, you know, obviously in the aughts, the 2000s, state government sort of lurched from one budget crisis to another. And we're right now in a very different place. And, you know, I can tell you what a transformation it's been over the past 20 years. And so, you know, a key consideration is, you know, will we return to that time or will we continue on with, you know, a sustainable state budget?
Jason Stein, the research director for Wisconsin Policy Forum, is our guest. We're going to take a quick break, come back with more with Jason on the other side, talking about this flat tax proposal and, in general, how taxes are used in the state of Wisconsin for you. It's your tax dollars. Back with more after this.
I'm the tax man. Yeah.
Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show. The time is now 10:50. Coming up at the top of the hour, join Kristen Bry and As Goes Wisconsin across the Civic Media Radio Network. At 2 o'clock, if you're listening to WXCO in Wausau, the great Chad Holmes has the mayor of Wausau on today. And she's fantastic. So tune in at 2 o'clock on WXCO for that Chad Holmes show with the mayor of Wausau as the guest today. Across the rest of the Civic Media Network, you can listen to Dueling Tangents with Luke Mathers and Brian Kelly as well. At 3 o'clock, we have Matt Flynn direct. At 4 o'clock, our flagship program, The Devil's Advocates with Crudy and Dom. At 6 o'clock, Native Roots. And at 7 or 8, starts the Rick Smith Show. So a bevy of entertainment and information throughout the day on the Civic Media Radio Network. None better, though, than the information you're getting right now from our guest. That is Jason Stein, the research director for Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, we appreciate having you with us, talking about this proposed flat tax by Republicans in the state legislature right now. I think it's always helpful to go back and take a look at history, and particularly through an organization like yourselves, who is a nonpartisan agency, because, you know, both sides, Republicans and Democrats, like to have a little revisionist history when it comes to tax issues, to put it in the best light. But looking back on Wisconsin's tax situation and income tax situation, what has that really been over the last few years, and how does that lead us to today?
Well, if you look at our overall tax burden in Wisconsin, so all state and local taxes, that has really come down considerably. We've tracked that, our organization, for 50 years. It's at the lowest level it's been when you look at taxes as a share of personal income in the state. It's never been lower. Our ranking nationally has fallen from within the top 10 to being a little bit below average. So our tax burden compared to other states has also gone down. At the same time, our income taxes remains relatively high. It's ranked like maybe 12th or 13th in terms of as a share of personal income in the state. Mm-hmm. And that's because we rely heavily on that. We have much lower sales taxes than a lot of other states. Mm-hmm. The other big shift that we've seen just within the income tax itself is it already has gotten a lot flatter over, you know, the past couple decades. You know, since 2008, if you look at the share of income, you say people at the low end of the income spectrum, their average tax rates have become less favorable. People at the top of the income spectrum, their rates have become somewhat more favorable. So the system has flattened itself a little bit already. This proposal would just supercharge that existing.
Is it fair to say, just looking at the facts and the numbers, that it's flattened more in favor of the higher earners than the lesser earners, the lower earners? Is that fair?
It's certainly been more favorable. You know, people at the low end of the income spectrum in Wisconsin, they continue to, on average, get payments from the government. So the bottom 20% would, you know, they would have a negative tax rate. In other words, they're actually receiving, you know, through things like the earned income tax credit, they would still receive money from the state. Whereas, you know, the people at the upper incomes still have the highest effective average tax rate. But the gap between those has gotten smaller rather than bigger over time. That's why I say that, we are getting a flatter income tax, or it has flattened over time. You know, the other thing to understand about this proposal is my understanding is the state's sliding scale standard deduction, which phases out as your income goes up, would still be there. Things like the earned income tax credit would still be there, which goes to low-income workers. So there would still be elements of this, of the state system under this proposal that would still be progressive. But, you know, the flip side of that is that I think a lot of people hear the term flat tax and they think, okay, this will be very simple to fill out my taxes now.
Right.
And I don't think that would be the case with this proposal. And the reason is that, to my understanding, it's not making any changes to the deductions or credits. And those are really, I think, what, when you're filling out your taxes, is adding the complexity, you know, understanding, you know, what income is included and excluded and things like that. As, you know, applying the brackets, you know, that's something that if you use TurboTax, it's done like that. And even if you don't, it's still relatively straightforward to do that. So really, that's something for your listeners to understand as well.
I think that's great information, because I was telling, talking to one of my co-hosts here at Civic, Luke Mathers, earlier on an earlier segment. We got talking a little bit about this proposal nationally, the proposed, you know, national sales tax and or going to a sale. And I said, look, this has been around since I worked for Scott Klug in Congress back in the 90s. The Gang of Seven and John Kasich and John Boehner and those folks, you know, they would hold up a card like this, and, you know, this size, basically a postcard, and say, this is the way you're going to do your income taxes. It's just going to be on this, and it was all the theory was that if you bought, you know, yachts and Jaguars, you're going to pay more tax because you're buying more, and the person paying, you know, buying less, a lower income, is going to pay less taxes. That's, I mean, that's what was being sold back in the 90s, and here we are in the 2023, and that same type of argument is being used in partisan arguments to sell things like this, and also the national sales tax.
I mean, there can be a lot of benefits to having a tax system that's relatively straightforward and easy to understand. I just don't think that in this particular case, that's going to change. And I don't think that that was really the point of the proposal either. I don't think it's, I'm not saying that it's a good thing to do that.
Yeah, I think it is important for, and believe me, I'm all for making a more simple tax code, easier to fill out your taxes. Just a couple of minutes left in the segment. Is there anything I haven't asked you yet, or you haven't talked about in this proposal you think is important for people to understand?
Well, I think it goes back to, you know, we have to some degree been experiencing this shift over the past, you know, 20 and 30 years in the state. So people have some, whether they realize it or not, background with this. It's just simply that this would really supercharge that change. You know, I think it comes down to, on the one hand, you know, what you sort of mean by opportunity and promoting the economy. And this certainly can be some benefits in terms of inducing people at the top to be more productive. But at the same time, people at the bottom also may rely on things like infrastructure, education, K-12 schools, universities, for them to sort of reach their most productive selves as workers and as citizens. So, you know, it's sort of balancing those two things to think about what is really going to give us the most effective and, you know, sort of best outcomes for the state as a whole.
Jason Stein, Research Director for Wisconsin Policy Forum, cannot thank you enough for your time today. Excellent job. Excellent info for our listeners. Come back soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Appreciate you. Jason Stein, thank you very much. Also, Sean Murphy-Lopez and also Luke Mathers, thank you all for being with us, as well as our producer engineer, Mr. Aaron Zomerz. And as always, thank you for listening the most. We appreciate all of you. Back tomorrow. Until then, I'm Todd Allball. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Until tomorrow, keep banging on your drum.